We are happy to welcome back to the program one of our favorite guests. May Barenbaum is here. She's professor of entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects. And for a long time now has been coming and talking with us about insects on the show. As a matter of fact, this month we're celebrating our big 20th anniversary on Focus 580. So we have gone back and looked at some of the people who've been here a lot when they were first here. And I can tell you that May Barenbaum was first on Focus 580 August 6th of 1982. So it's been a while, and we're pleased that she's still coming back. One of the things that we'll do this morning is to talk about a very significant event coming up on this campus, an event which has now become world famous, something that she started. It's the Insect Fear Film Festival, 18th annual. It's coming up this weekend on Saturday. So we'll talk about that. And then, of course, if you have questions, what we do when May is here is we say if you have questions about insects, you can call us, and she'll see if she can answer your question. We always say also when we do these shows, save your extermination questions for another day. This is coexistence. Live and let live. Appreciate them if you can for their interesting diversity, and we'll deal with somebody else when it comes time to squash them. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers if you want to call us. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
How about that? August of 1982.
I remembered it was 82. I couldn't say that I remembered it was August.
So. No, you didn't. You didn't remember it was 82. You did?
Actually, I think I was supposed to be on with someone else, and she didn't end up coming.
So you did it was, just you?
Yeah, I think it was just
and
me.
Probably filled you with trepidation?
Just like today.
I still
don't get used to this.
No, I don't get that either. Well, anyway.
A lot like prelims, you know. You don't know where the questions are coming from. So.
But it's a friendly sort of interrogation. I mean, it's not, you know, your entire academic career is not at stake.
No, just my status in the WILL listening area.
Oh, well.
No, it's fine.
So the Fear Film Festival is coming up again, and the theme insect is?
Beetles this year.
Beetles.
About time that we
So you're going to show Hard Day's Night?
Well, actually, the T-shirts this year are the image. There's actually two designs, but my personal favorite is the T-shirt has on the front basically the cover of Abbey Road, but crossing the road instead of four beetles are four beetles. So B-E-E-T-L-E-S. So that's and we had a lot of, well, I don't know, I had a lot of fun with the sort of, you know, the Fab 250,000 is who we'll be honoring at this festival. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the connections between Beatles, the Coleopteran sort, and Beatles, the musical sort. Remember the great hit from the Beatles, the Norwegian Wood Borer? Remember that album? That was a good one.
Yeah, I think I have that.
Maxwell Silver Ham Beetle. There's another one. So there are all kinds of allusions to insects.
I guess I was never really quite aware just how important insect themes were. I'm sure will cause me to listen to them in a completely different way.
Well, then we've done our job, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Maybe next year it'll be Buddy Holly and the Crickets or something. I don't know.
So we have a caller. Why don't we talk with them, and then we will also talk more about the festival, and you can tell folks about the movies that you're going to show. All right. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Not a question, but I was at Pages for All Ages the other day and looked over at their rolls of wrapping paper, and they had a whole huge fat roll of insect plastered wrapping paper. I mean, it wasn't real insects. It was gorgeous, colorful ones. So head in that direction, anybody. You want to have wrapped in beetle wrapping paper or insect wrapping paper.
There's actually some gorgeous insect wrapping paper with real beetles.
Oh, really?
Which, if you ever get a gift from me, you might see. I'm very undiscriminating. If it has an insect on it, I'll buy it. So people get baby presents from me with insect themes, and they're wrapped in insect paper. But one very famous source for insect wrapping paper is a decorative artist from earlier in the 20th century named Segui, who, insects were his muse. He drew inspiration from insects and initially was very realistic and then kind of got more and more Art Nouveau and decorative. So you can often find Segui wrapping paper with insect images.
Well, dragonflies seem to be really big lately, too.
Dragonflies are in. That's a very astute observation. These things come in waves. It used to be ladybugs, but now seems to be dragonflies. So.
What's the difference between a dragonfly and a damselfly in terms of their relation to each other?
Well, they're in the same big group, same order. It's the order Odonata. But they're in different parts of the order. And dragonflies, you can always tell the difference because dragonflies hold their wings out straight over their backs and, well, sort of straight out to the side. And damselflies hold their wings up right over their backs, sort of at kind of, well, right angles to the ground. Dragonflies tend to be a little more heavy-bodied, and there's also a difference in the immatures, the larvae. All the immatures are aquatic, but the aquatic damselflies have sort of flat tails, and the immature dragonflies have what's called a rectal gill. You can't really see any outside appurtenances, but they use it to breathe underwater, and they also use it for jet propulsion. So subtle differences, but same general group, but different sides of the fence within the order Odonata.
Always amazes me how they can mate and fly at the same time.
Oh, and it's not an easy business mating if you're a dragonfly because I don't know if you've seen, the male has to curl his abdomen around. They basically end up, because he has claspers on one segment and a genital opening on another segment. I don't know. This is a little hard to do on the radio. Probably better suited for television or something.
Well, I'm already starting to feel like Howard Stern here.
But they'll fly around like that for hours and hours in tandem, sort of in a heart shape. And I think it's in part because it probably takes so long to untangle.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you were looking for your insect wrapping paper, you can head over there to Pages for Ologists. Now, you said you had some wrapping paper that actually had real insects in it?
Well, images of, not like bodies of.
Okay. Now there, I'm glad I asked.
Although I do have coasters with real butterfly wings in them. That's a sort of a major folk art form in Asia. You take butterfly wings and use them in various ways. In fact, there's some in Taiwan. There's a little cottage industry that consists of constructing entire tableaus from butterfly wing scales, just scale by scale in a mosaic fashion. So
it must be very time consuming.
Yeah, I can't imagine that pays very well either. But anyway.
Our guest is Mae Barenbaum. She's professor and head of entomology at the U of I. And every once in a while she's here, we talk about insects, appreciating them, not killing them, and her reason for being here. First time this year is to talk a little bit about the upcoming Insect Fear Film Festival on Saturday on the campus. It's free. And it's always a lot of fun. They show movies that feature various kinds of insects, often very large ones. Another case is just, you know, hostile ones. And also use it as an opportunity to do a little teaching about insects and what they're really like. So we'll tell you more about that. And questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. There's a caller in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm not asking questions or needing information. I just thought that everybody might be interested to know that spring is going to come. I have ants. That one warm spell did it.
Well, they're usually good predictors. So, but not to worry. Generally, ants are indoors this time of year because their major source of food, which is aphid honeydew, isn't available.
Yeah.
What often happens is once spring really hits and the aphids wake up.
Oh, they go away?
Then they'll just, well, no promises here, but often
this is an annual problem, but this is about a month or more early. I just thought that if anybody else was wondering, they're still here.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's a little early for aphids, so they may end
way
up.
Way early.
Yeah, right.
So then when the natural food sources become available, then chances are the ants are going to go back outside where they'd really probably rather be.
It depends on the ant species. There are, of course, many hundreds of ant species, but only a few that are really household pests on any kind of regular basis.
Well, I just bag up everything.
It's funny you should mention that. This morning I saw the little ant trap that I'd set out last fall when we had ants. just noticed it behind the cookie jar for the, you know, I guess it had been hidden all winter. And oftentimes ant problems are self-limiting, and again, depends on the species. A lot are these are not the carpenter ants, are they?
These are little tiny quarter-inch black ones.
Yeah, those are likely to go abandon your house when the pickings get better.
Well, as soon as
better.
It gets really warm and stays warm, they go away. But they're a big nuisance until. I just thought I would report a very early sighting.
No, oh, thank you.
And. That's all I had to offer for this morning. I really enjoy your program.
Well, thanks for calling. And other people, if you'd like to call in.
The heck with groundhogs. Who needs groundhogs, right?
That's right. It's when the ants, if the ants see their shadows or if they come into the house, then it means springs are right around the corner, I guess.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Tell us about the movies you're going to show.
Well, we have our usual assortment of Hollywood's most dubious efforts. The theme this year, as I mentioned, is beetle, the largest order of insects and collectively the most numerous or most species-rich group of organisms on the planet.
That was the number you gave, 250,000. That's the number of species?
Yeah, about a quarter of all insects are beetles. So there are a lot of beetles in the world. And in fact, just about anything an insect can do, there's a beetle that's capable of doing it. They're incredibly diverse. And there are a lot of insects that people don't even realize are beetles, like fireflies, for example. Even though they're called fireflies or lightning bugs, they're not flies, they're not bugs, they're really beetles. Our first movie is an animated feature-length film called Magic Voyage. And it's about, it's hard to say what it's about. You can't really tell from looking at this character what it's supposed to be. He identifies himself as a shipworm, and we think that's a ship timber beetle or Limaxolonid beetle, although there are some creatures that are actually mollusks that bore through wood that are sometimes called shipworms. But this guy also bores through books, so he's a bookworm of sorts. And bookworms can be various forms of stored product beetles as well. So Magic Voyage is about Pico, the woodworm, who befriends Christopher Columbus, rounds off a square wooden globe in Christopher Columbus's office, and inspires Columbus to go sail off in search of Asia and to discover the New World, and accompanies him to rescue his firefly Inamorata, who's been captured by the Swarm Lord, some evil agglomeration of flying things. I can't say this is... this one is straddles that very fine line between really bad and really bad to be amusing and bad enough to be amusing. So we're hoping it falls on that side of the line. It was, I think, a German production, so it's dubbed, animated film dubbed. And among the notables voicing characters are Corey Feldman, former child star, now wannabe rock musician, and Dom DeLuise of... I guess Smokey and the Bandit fame.
So many, too numerous to mention, really.
And accompanying that film, we'll have an animated short called Sniffles and the Bookworm. Again, keeping up with that bookworm theme. Do you want the rest of the lineup, or should we take a call?
Well, I suppose we could keep people in suspense. We'll go ahead and take a call rather than make them wait. You're at line one. Hello, in Champaign.
Hi. Since you mentioned the carpenter ants, could you describe what they look like? And I have another question. Are insects attracted to wood siding on a house?
Well, carpenter ants are pretty easy to distinguish from any other kind of ant in this part of North America because they're the biggest ants in North America. If you see anything that's a half an inch or large, then you can be pretty much certain that it's a carpenter ant.
Okay.
They're black. And I'd say size is probably the best identifier for these guys.
Okay.
And they are unwelcome in houses, not because they eat wood like termites, mm-hmm. but they make their homes in woods. And so carpenter is really not a bad descriptor. They tunnel through the wood, and you can always differentiate carpenter ant damage from, say, termite damage, because termites actually ingest the wood, and it ends up looking kind of wet and sort of gooey. And carpenter ants just make sawdust. So let's see if another if you squash them, another distinguishing feature is they have sort of an acidic odor about them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the formic acid, so that's sort of the typical ant defensive compound. Although there are a lot of ants that don't smell quite like that. There's a one ant called the citronella ant that smells like lemons, and there's an ant called the odorous house ant that doesn't smell very nice at all. so that's another thing. Carpenter ants like sweet stuff, and they don't sting, but they will bite,
mm-hmm.
and they do have big jaws because they're big ants.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I have them then, since they're that big. Mine aren't. I saw them last summer when I roofed my house, and they were black, and they were kind of big, but the way you're describing them, I don't think there's carpenter ants. And I have a wood-sided house, and I seem to have a tremendous spider problem, and I was wondering if that's attracting them.
Oh, the ants going after the spiders? Why is it a problem to have the spiders?
I seem to have them everywhere. I mean, when spring comes, I usually leave them alone outside of the house because I want to keep the mosquitoes down.
Yeah,
But inside the house, it gets a little annoying.
Well, I wouldn't say they're necessarily attracted to wood siding,
mm-hmm.
but wood is their medium of expression.
Yeah, well, I have a beautiful crawl space for them to live in, or so they seem to enjoy it down there. I don't mind if they just stay down there. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have three different things I'd like to ask of you. One is a comment. My daughter and I recently were in Africa, and we went to Luxor. And, of course, the scarab is a very holy thing for the Egyptians. And they talked about the importance of the 40-day and 40-night life of the dung beetle, and that is how they decided to use mummification for the return of the dead. You probably know all about that, but I thought it was very interesting.
Actually, there's a whole enormous literature about how and why the scarabs were worshipped, and I think one of the most interesting aspects of that particular literature, you can see how the idea of metamorphosis carries over to reincarnation. You see these beetles emerging from balls of waste of dung.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been argued by some anthropologists that, in fact, the pyramids themselves are what have been called deified dung pats. They're just the Egyptians' effort to recreate a dung pat. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is interesting, and I should read more about it. But it was wonderful to be there. Also, this morning I've been out working in the yard, and I have found pieces of what appear to be honeycomb, and I have to think that it came from one of our big old trees. I don't know whether it was blown out or if perhaps an animal, I do live in the country, and perhaps an animal has been up scrounging around in the tree. I would like to send some of it to my granddaughter in Oregon. However, I know that even though they are wild bees, could the mites have infested them, and would it be dangerous to send something of that nature into the area where Harry and David have some wonderful fruit growing and perhaps, endanger their efforts? The other thing I wanted to ask is the name of your book, the one about stings and sex. I do want to order it, and I live in Terre Haute, and I need to know more about it so that I can order it with some knowledge.
I think the book you're referring to is Buzzwords. The subtitle is Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. Is that the one? Okay.
Yes.
That's so that's Buzzwords. It's the Joseph Henry Press. So.
Joseph Henry.
Uh-huh. That's the publisher.
Okay.
And I hope you like it. As for the honeycomb, it's considerate for you to think of that. And in fact, it is a concern, although I doubt that, the mites that the caller is referring to, they're two species of parasitic mites that have actually just devastated feral or wild populations of honeybees and have actually had a major impact as well on managed colonies. And the two species are sort of differ in their approach. One's called the tracheal mite and one is called the varroa mite. And the varroa is sometimes called the vampire mite because it sucks the blood of drones and also of brood, the grubs of bees. And my guess is if that comb has been out in the weather for as long as it seems to have been, that it's unlikely these parasitic mites remain because they're really dependent on their hosts.
Okay.
I suppose you could always stick it in the freezer for a few weeks if you want to be absolutely sure there's no living material on it. Mm-hmm. And I confess I don't know what the I know that there are USDA restrictions on mailing particularly live materials across state lines, but I don't know that there is any I don't know of laws preventing, you know, people from putting bits of honeycomb in the mail. I don't know doesn't mean it's necessarily.
But you're suggesting the freezer for.
Well, if you're worried about mites, then sticking things in the, you know, just your regular freezer for a couple of days.
Yes.
You want to be a couple of weeks to be absolutely sure will kill anything that's living. The thing about living in a honeybee hive is it's like. Well, I guess it's paradise from the arthropod perspective, except for those angry stinging bees. The honeybees can maintain the temperature of their hive at around 65 degrees, even when it gets to, you know, below zero outside. They can regulate the temperature and regulate the humidity. So as a result, inquilines, which is a term used for uninvited guests in social insect nests, tend not to be the most robust of organisms because they're used to having it easy. They can tolerate, you know, they don't have a wide range of tolerance for environmental conditions. So.
Do you think a raccoon or even an opossum might have gone into the tree and disturbed it?
Entirely likely. I'm not sure possums are quite that agile. I mean, I always see them flattened by the side of the road. So, so I don't know if they actually could manage to extricate something. A raccoon's a possibility. I don't know if you're far enough out in the country for bears, but honey is a very attractive resource for a lot of organisms. Very concentrated calories and relatively localized in space. You don't have to go hunting for it. And it's one of the reasons bees sting, because so many things would like to steal honey.
Mm-hmm. Well, my husband and I had noticed over the last 3 or 4 years about the demise of the bees, because they've always found me, even when we were fishing out in Lake Michigan. And when they stopped bothering me, we knew that there was a shortage.
They were in trouble, yeah.
Now, we did go into the woods a couple of years ago, and there was a beautiful hive of wild bees out there, and we could hear them as we walked under the tree. They hear them buzzing, and even they seem to have been, wiped out or moved. Maybe they moved to another tree. I don't know. And we do live in the country about 8 miles out of Terre Haute, so there are a lot of critters around here. And anyway, I really appreciate it. I wish I could get to see your film festival, because it has always sounded so wonderful. And after seeing Hannibal, I think that maybe the Beatles would have a better chance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, the Silence of the Lambs is the one with the insect connection. Had the Death's Head Moth was the
The one that was used in their advertising campaign?
Well, it was because it was shoved down the throat of one of the victims of the serial killer. So.
I see. I'm much too sensitive to watch movies like that. I stay away from that kind of stuff.
And it wasn't actually a death's head moth in the movie. What it was Manduka sex and tobacco hornworm that was painted to look like a death's head moth. You know, can't trust anything in Hollywood.
A little bit past the midpoint here with our guest, May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is here on the show. And we invite your questions on insects. And almost about this time of year now for a while, we've asked her to come and talk about the Insect Fear Film Festival. It's happening this weekend on Saturday on the campus at Folinger Auditorium. It's free. And as is the case now for the last, 18 years, they show films that have insects as prominent characters, and also at the same time they have graduate students and faculty people there to talk about insects and answer questions, and they have an insect petting zoo and all kinds of fun stuff for the kids. So if you're looking for something to do with your family, you might think about that. And then as the films get later in the evening, they get sort of more like not for kids.
Absolutely.
So the earlier part of the evening, maybe that's where if you have small children, you can bring them. And then later on, it's the adult hour of the festival.
Actually, our second feature, we were going to show The Mummy, which features flesh-eating scarabs, as was alluded to earlier, not the flesh-eating part. But really, insects were so minimal in that we've substituted it with our second feature, which is Meet the Applegates. I just want to say that's an R-rated movie. Mm-hmm. I saw the quizzical look. This is a very obscure movie. It's basically the story of enormous, disgruntled Amazonian Cocorado rainforest beetles who are upset with humans for ruining the environment. So they assume human form and settle in a typical American town with a typical American nuclear power plant. You can see where that's going. Mm-hmm. But before they can accomplish their mission, they end up being sort of seduced by human weaknesses. Now, that they are beetles is indicated only by about three-quarters of the way through the film. They actually look like praying mantids, but three-quarters of the way through the film, a scientist, a consultant, a professor, Dr. Fishpaw, who pronounces these to be Cocorado beetles from South American rainforests. So, but that's an R-rated movie. And before that one, we're going to show a piece of a documentary film called Cane Toads. And Cane Toads is the story of biocontrol gone horribly awry. The gray-backed sugarcane beetle was a major pest in cane fields in Australia, and someone had the bright idea of bringing Bufo marinus, the cane toad, and releasing them for biological control, not realizing, and there are two species of beetles in the cane fields that were big pests. Now, the cane toads do eat beetles, but not beetles that live in high up in the sugar cane. So they never really even managed to eat these beetles, but they really took to Australia. They have no natural enemies. They secrete a poison, actually. So a lot of dogs died picking up these toads, enormous creatures. And now the cane toads themselves are a plague. That's kind of a famous documentary. And I guess just to finish up the program, the third feature, also R-rated, is The Relic, which features insects only, beetles only minimally, mostly about an anthropologist who ships back a crate of fungus-contaminated leaves from a tropical locale just about the time a brain-sucking, slavering monster ends up prowling the halls of the Field Museum in Chicago.
That's the best part.
And it turns out that the Dermestid beetle colony plays a significant role. Just about every museum of any size in this country maintains a colony of beetles called skin or hide beetles or Dermestids. And they do this because the Dermestid beetles are the best way science has for cleaning off skeletons. These beetles eat dead things, that's what they do for a living, and they're extremely good at removing the last little tiny bit of tissue from bone, better than harsh chemicals, better than scrubbing. So most museums keep a colony on hand. Our Natural History Museum on campus had a domestic colony for many years. But you want to make sure their DNA stays put, if you get my drift here.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. We have some other folks here. Somebody on a mobile phone, so let's get them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Hi, May.
Hi.
I had a question for you today about earwigs, because I've actually read in a couple of different documents conflicting information regarding those little pinchers, whether they actually just use them for posturing and they're not actually functional, or whether they can actually use them as a defensive or offensive weapon.
Well, those little pinchers are called, they're sometimes called forceps, are used primarily for mating and courtship, and can actually be used to manipulate potential mates or potential competitors for mates. My understanding is that they can, in fact, pinch. I don't know anyone who's been sort of seriously injured for any length of time by one, but their main function is not so much defense as it is impressing a potential mate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Another defense they have is they do smell bad, so something to remember.
Well, we see them every summer, and we've always wondered, although I've never been pinched by one, so.
I don't know anyone who has either.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Do the on the earwig, do both males and females have them?
Yeah, unlike stag beetles, where there's a really pronounced dimorphism, that is, the females and males look very different. That difference isn't quite so dramatic in the species that we have that's common here. The species we have that's common here is actually introduced from Europe. It's not native. The one that everybody finds in your basement or in your garden is not a native species. It was introduced around the turn of the century, I think originally into the Pacific Northwest. But there are earwigs where there's a, you know, a really conspicuous difference between males and females.
Okay. Let's talk with someone next in Robinson on line one. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask Ms. Berenbaum, in view of the discussion of insects and beetles and decorative arts, if she is aware that in the 1890s, beetle carapaces, wing covers, were used as sequins on ladies' dresses. There's a famous portrait, I think, of Sarah Bernhardt wearing a dress which is almost completely sequined with blue-green beetle wing covers. And in motion, they were iridescent. It must have looked like a walking Tiffany lamp.
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit I paid an obscene amount of money for a pair of earrings. I don't even wear earrings from the late 19th century that were beetle carapaces, iridescent. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. That was very popular in that era, that beetle wings were used decoratively. There's a long history, actually. There's a shrine in Japan, which I think is 17th century. The walls are bedecked with buprested wing covers. Prestids are sometimes called the flat-headed wood borers, and they're iridescent, magnificent metallic colors. So, that's beetles are appreciated. Not only, I mean, they're not just pests, but they've brought aesthetic quality to our lives.
Good.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're aware of that. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Now, maybe we could start marketing clothing made out of Japanese beetles. Maybe we'd have something there. Now, see, I would think that using it that way for a piece of clothing would be that what you'd end up with was something that would be so fragile, you would constantly be worried that you were going to mash them. You couldn't sit on it, in a dress like that, if it had it on the bottom, could you?
Well, I think it might depend on the beetle. There are some pretty tough beetles out there. The Prestons are kind of they're elytra, they're wing covers. It wouldn't crumble at the touch, but I think it's probably all in the setting. Earrings sound to me like a better idea than maybe a dress.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. But, I think Japanese beetle clothing. There, we got to be onto something there. Let's go to Danforth here, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just had a comment. I tuned in a little late, but I heard the lady talking about the honeybee and the cone and so on. And last year, or maybe 2 years ago, I just received the most lovely book, and it's called A Hive for the Honeybee. and it makes you feel like you're just a honeybee, and it's so original. And I wondered if you were familiar with that book. And it's the author is a woman from Ireland, Lally, L-A-L-L-Y is her last name.
It's called The Hive for the Honeybee?
A Hive for the Honeybee.
Because there's a very famous book called The Hive and the Honeybee, but it's more of like a text for apiculturists. But this is not one I've seen.
Oh, it just makes you want to be in the hive. And you commented about some of the things that bees do. And evidently this is based on real facts, such as when a mouse got in the hive and how they killed it and how they covered it with wax and it was there. But is this something that maybe I'm not, that I'm believing that may not be true?
Well, actually, it's, what they cover it is with is a substance called propolis.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And that's absolutely true, that it's a material collected from tree resins. They go out and a certain group of bees will collect, you know, stuff that oozes out of particular trees like willows and poplars and the like and bring it back. And they use this stuff to plug holes, but also to seal up any kind of waste or contamination in the hive, and like a dead mouse. And interestingly, propolis is now being investigated as a source for antioxidants, for antimicrobial agents. And if you go to health food stores, you can sometimes see propolis chewing gum, propolis toothpaste.
Oh, interesting.
And various sorts. So it's being exploited for its antimicrobial and medicinal properties. Yeah, bees are just like flying drugstores. There are all kinds of materials that they make or collect that have biological or pharmacological properties.
Well, I just found it to be interesting. I love hearing your program every time you,
you.
Are on. And I just thought I would add that little bit of information about a hive for the honey.
Well, that's one I'm definitely going to have to look up. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, and thank you. And we have about 10 minutes left. We have time for other calls. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Mae Barenbaum. She's a professor of entomology at the University of Illinois. Now, I'm sure a couple more times here in the coming months, once it gets a little bit warmer and the insects become more active, she'll be here and we'll do these programs about insects, inviting questions. Again, not extermination ones. We got a guy for that, Phil Nixon. I'm sure he'll be here, and we'll do that as well. But when May is here, we try to encourage questions just about coexistence, appreciating insects for the many different forms they take.
And the fact that I've been here for 19 years, I think, is a testimony to the enormous diversity of insects.
Ought to count for something.
Never run out of subjects.
About this time of the year, also, she comes by, and we talked a little bit about the Insect Fear Film Festival that she started about 18 years ago. And it's coming up this weekend on the campus. So if you're interested in you're looking for something to do, it can be entertaining.
It's
and
free.
It's free.
6 hours
That's
of
right.
entertainment. Absolutely free.
And if you would like to talk with her, with May, 333-9455 here in Urbana and toll free 800-222-9455.
One thing I promised to do that I know we're running out of time. We're this year again, we've brought back the insect art contest. Kids all over the area have sent in insect drawings or arthropod drawings. We've gotten over 250 entries, and there's some very decent prizes. And the winner is will have his or her work framed, courtesy of international galleries, and will be presented with a traveling trophy, which, in honor of the festival, has a gold laminated beetle at the top.
So. Mm-hmm. And is it possible still to enter, or has
judging
that closed?
Judging is going on as we speak, I believe. So.
All right. Very good. Let's see. We have a few more folks. Let's go to, I believe, Urbana next. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We handpicked 2,500 Japanese beetles last summer. Do you have any suggestions? They were mostly on the roses.
Yeah, they love roses. That's and hand picking is probably the most efficient thing to do. The one thing you shouldn't do, at least from what I've read, is put up Japanese beetle traps.
No, we didn't do that. Yeah. The neighbors did.
Well, what that does, they work in a sense in that they are baited with floral volatiles, the odors that emanate from flowers that they are particularly fond of, which include roses. They like grapes too. And what it does is it draws them into the neighborhood. So unfortunately, they're far more than can fit in the trap. So people who put out traps tend to have greater problems, not fewer problems, with Japanese beetles. And again, I'm not the right one to ask about effective control measures. I know that there are many products out there. There's a fungal disease called milky spore, I think it's fungal, that attacks the beetles in their larval stages, where they even though as adults they'll feed on literally hundreds of different plant species. I think they have 300 species to their credit as potential hosts. When they're in their grub stage, they tend to feed on the grasses only, on the roots only of grasses. So you know how kids are always fussier than their parents. Well, these kids are very fussy. So some of the control measures are targeted during the more vulnerable and less mobile larval stage. But Phil Nixon at the Natural History Survey can probably tell you what's been working best. But you know, I'm from the Northeast, so I grew up with these guys. You know, people in Illinois, they're only within the last 10 years or so have they made any inroads in the state. But as the name suggests, they were introduced from Japan around 1916, not far from New Jersey, actually. And they were part of my childhood. That was one of my jobs, was to go out and collect the Japanese beetles off the grapevines.
Can you predict the population for this summer from last summer's population or not?
That's hard to say. Among other things, how abundant the population will be is very regional. I don't know that it's completely well understood as to why one area can be heavily infested and then just, you know, down the road, another area be remarkably free, beetle-free. So a lot of it has to do with exactly the location where you are. And again, the Cooperative Extension Service has maps of where outbreaks have been and how the population is moving. As you might imagine, there's a lot of interest in following the conquest of the state by these relative newcomers.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure that sometime soon, I would think probably within the next couple of months, we'll probably have Phil on the show, and he's the guy who should have all that info. Phil Nixon, extension entomologist. So he's our exterminator guy. When we have him on the program, we say, okay, now is the time. If you have insects you want to get rid of, we can try and help you with that. And I'm sure that he has Japanese beetle information. He was on last summer, I think. One day he came and he said, you know, I was kind of thinking about bringing you some. I guess he had a few in his yard. And I said, no, thank you. That's okay. I think last summer was the first time that I remember in my yard in Urbana seeing them. Now,
well,
maybe they were
new,
there,
yeah,
but
they're pretty new to the area. So, you know, they still aren't immediately recognized by everybody. So it's, although if New Jersey, I grew up in the general metropolitan New York area, and they're pretty much they may very well be part of an Illinois childhood someday soon.
Okay. Mononk, I think, next here, line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got another ant question.
Okay.
We have these small red-brown ants that come in the house, and they only come in July and June, July, and August, and we were wondering what kind of ant they are. They come in trails.
Are they, ants often do. How small are they?
Oh, hard to explain. Like half the size of a pencil eraser, lengthwise.
Half the size.
Or smaller.
Because they're as you might guess, a lot of little brown ants. Thief ants are, I guess, sort of bronzish in color, and they're about a tenth of an inch long. They're really pretty small.
Okay.
There is a species of pharaoh ant. Some of them are black, but the most common one is kind of yellowish-red. They're about a tenth of an inch long. They're very common indoor ants. They're very, very hard to get rid of.
Okay.
They're the typical house ant, the pharaoh ants.
Okay.
So that might be what you got there.
That makes sense. We've had them, like, for 20 years, and I've never gotten rid of them. My main question is, what are they doing now? What happens to them in the winter?
Well, ant colonies are perennial. I can't say that for all ants, but they they can spend the winter, but they tend to move unless they're living in if they're living outdoors, they just move deeper in the soil and sort of keep activities to a very low level. So they're just generally waiting out the bad weather. You know, insects aren't being cold-blooded, don't move around a whole lot when it's very cold. And most ant colonies aren't so precisely regulated in terms of temperature and humidity as, say, honeybee colonies are. So they're kind of at the mercy of the environment, even though being a soil dwelling buffers them from a lot of environmental problems.
You would have thought of all the years, you know, like real wet years, they would have been flooded out at some time.
Well, ants are also very mobile. It's a lot easier to move an ant nest, unless it happens to be like a leafcutter nest or something, than it is to move a honeybee colony, because everything is pretty portable. You've probably seen them moving, you know, carrying their little kids on their backs. So there's they're a lot more mobile than a lot of other social insects. So, you know, when the floodwaters rise, they just head out of town.
Okay. Thank you for the information.
Thank you.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, here we have one person we can't take, but I'm sure later in spring, May, we'll be back and we'll do this some more. And in the meantime, this weekend at the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus, it's the 18th annual Insect Fear Film Festival, Beetles on the Big Screen. Somebody wanted to know, by the way, how they can get a T-shirt. Do they have to go to the festival?
You could, well, we'll be taking orders at the festival. There'll be a few to sell, but not a lot. But if you want to call the department office, you can probably put an order in. There are two designs this year, and I'm really partial to the Abbey Road
one. That sounds pretty cool to me.
And it's 333-2910.
Okay.
And we'll do another run just for people for the festival.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you,
good
as always.
You.